south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 257, covering the week of April 12th through April 16th, 2021. Glad to have you back on the program. Very glad to be here. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, and subscribe to our YouTube page. You can find all those social media accounts at our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org. That's A-B-B-E-V-I-L-L-E, institute.org. While you're there, give us an email address. We'll give you a free ebook, Exploring the Southern Tradition. It's yours free of charge. All you got to do is give us an email address, and you get on that email list. It's our best way to communicate with you. It's how we send you our daily dose of Dixie, Monday through Friday. It's how we let you know about our upcoming conferences, our Zoom conferences. It's how we fundraise. This is how we keep in contact with the people that mean most to us. So if you like the Institute, please give us that email address and please fill out the information there so we can contact you and keep in touch with you. That's what we really want to be able to do more than anything else. Now, we do have an event coming up. If you've been on our email list, you know about this. It's our summer school. It takes place between July 18th and 23rd at Seabrook Island, South Carolina. It's our annual event. It was canceled last year because of COVID. We are going to have it this year, and we're really looking forward to it. Of course, we need students, and we have a number of scholarships available. So if you are an advanced high school student, an undergraduate, college undergraduate, or a graduate student, and you want to attend the summer school, please go to our website, abbevilleinstitute.org. Click on that You're Invited section in the middle. Look at it. Get the information. Contact Don Livingston and Marie Livingston and let them know you're interested in attending. We have very few slots left overall for anything, so the event is pretty much sold out. But if you want to attend, make it known and let people know you want to go. Let Don and Marie know you want to go. Also, we have our Zoom conferences. We have another one coming up next week, and that one is already sold out. These things sell out fast. If you're on our email list, you're going to know about them. So make sure you get on that email list, long story short. We also exist on your generous contributions alone. So if you like the podcast, if you like the website, if you like our conferences, you like these things we do, then please consider a tax-deductible donation to the Institute. That's how we continue our mission to explore what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition. And as always, share our material on social media, rate it wherever you get your podcasts. Let people know you're listening to this podcast. Let people know you're reading our material. That's how we get more people involved. We're facing an insurmountable task in many ways, and that's preservation of the Southern tradition and offering an explanation of it that's valuable for modern society. I mean, look, when you look at modern society and you see what's going on, the hypocrisy of the northern side of it, this righteous cause myth, it's so ridiculous. But this is what we're facing, and the Southern tradition still offers much to modern American society and how to live. Critique on government, society, these kind of things. I mean, there's a lot of it there, and it's a 400-year history. It's not just a four-year period of the war. It's not just the antebellum South. It's also the postbellum South. What did Southerners in the postbellum period have to say that was valuable about Southern tradition? For example, corporations, which are in the news all the time now because of the wokeism that's saturating American society, but Southerners had long been opposed to corporations, going all the way back to John Taylor of Caroline. And, you know, the Jeffersonians, the Republicans, who are concerned about the fusion of government and finance. And, of course, corporations were part of that. You have Who Owns America, published in 1936 with a Southern economist writing a nice essay about corporate personhood and how this thing was completely alien to the Southern tradition. This whole idea of giving corporations the status of personhood, that's something that the North wanted, not the South. Now, Southerners have eventually gone along with these things, but at first there was a substantial Southern opposition to this idea. You could say it's Jeffersonian, if you want, but certainly it's Southern. And I think that that's the part that we need to understand, that people need to understand. We need to get that message out. The Southern tradition still has currency. It's still important in modern society. The critiques of executive overreach, judicial overreach, legislative overreach, all of these things, the right of self-government, real federalism, all these things are compiled within that Southern tradition. Southern culture, whether it's music or culinary arts, art, these kind of things are so important for modern society. And we try to do all of this stuff on a regular basis at the Institute. And of course, a lot of times we're reacting to what's going on. whether it's an attack on military installations named after Confederate soldiers or leaders, whether it's an attack on Robert E. Lee at Washington and Lee University, whether it's attack on Stonewall Jackson at VMI, whether it's an attack on Confederate monuments or George Washington or Thomas Jefferson, whatever it may be, we do respond to these things. Or it's attack on John C. Calhoun. We try to do that because we want to stand up for the important parts of the Southern tradition. We also like to give you a positive affirmation of the Southern tradition. I mean, it's not just about complaining about things, but we want to be clear that there is an affirmation of what it is. And it, you know, Bell Bradford, you know, not in defense, but an affirmation. I mean, these are important things. We have to affirm what the Southern tradition means for modern American society, the good parts of it, right? I mean, we all know there's bad parts of the Southern tradition. Nobody's glossing over that. Nobody's saying, well, those things didn't exist. Well, certainly some bad things, things we wouldn't want to emulate or replicate today, right? Those things are there in any tradition. But would you hack down the entire rose bush because it has thorns when the flower is so beautiful and smells so good? No, you wouldn't. Nobody would do that in their right mind. Nobody would do that. But yet, this is what people are doing with the Southern tradition. They're hacking it all down because they want to cut out the evil, quote-unquote, of American society. And it's a short-sighted, ahistorical approach to all of these things. I wrote an essay for Chronicles Magazine, and you know, and Don Livingston and I had a conversation about it. And one of the points I made in it is what we're doing in modern society right now is debating who's the least racist among people, and those are the only people that can be used as examples of the American character and American tradition. We're losing the virtue. And he pointed out Hume's history. I think he said it was Hume's history. I'm trying to think now of England, where he talked about the different kings, their virtues and their vices, and this is how you weighed the character of the man. So if you look at Robert E. Lee, certainly he had vices. He's a man. He's not perfect, but he had substantial virtues as well, and those virtues made him a great man. This is why Booker T. Washington said that Confederate monuments should be erected to great men. We should have the greatest men on display so we can all emulate these people. It's no different than putting Booker T. Washington on a monument. There's a great man. A great man who did great things for the African-American community of Alabama, but overall in American society did great things, worthy of emulation. Somebody that you could say, this man is someone that we should look to with respect. There are lots of people like that, and some of them have unsavory things that we don't find nice, considering coming from a 21st century perspective. We could say that about just about anybody in the 18th or 19th century. Look, the 19th century and the 18th century, Americans were racist. It didn't matter who you were, they were racist. So if we're going to say that, well, then if you're going to follow the logic of the 1619 Project or the left, then none of these people can be admired. None of them. Unless they are anti-racist, which you can find maybe a handful of those people, or they're from a minority group. Those are the only people that can be admired. Well, that's just completely stupid, to be frank. It's ridiculous, but this is the idea. The idea is power and to destroy Western civilization. That is the point. To destroy Western civilization and all the foundations of Western civilization, which, by the way, we all live under the blessings of. Even the Black Lives Matter leader who now has spent millions of dollars on homes, who's a supposed Marxist. Well, this is how Marxists operate, right? I mean, they operate under this way. They operate in a way that would allow them to enrich themselves where everyone else drives a Yugo and lives in a one-bedroom flat and can't get a pair of blue jeans. But they live in complete splendor. I mean, this is what Marxism does. But you have somebody who's living in the blessings of Western civilization. That money came from people with money, right? Which you don't have if you don't have the modern society that we have today. People are wealthier today. An average middle-class American lives better than Charlemagne did in the 8th century AD. 9th century AD. Lives better than Charlemagne. Charlemagne would be envious of the things that we have in modern American society. Now, most of us don't have the power that Charlemagne has, but had. But regardless, the health, the food, the comforts, we're so well off. We complain about being oppressed or whatever it is. I mean, different people do. It's ridiculously laughable when you think about it on the surface. Laughable. Laughable. Yet people buy into it because they have this perception of egalitarianism, equity, equality, whatever term you want to use, and a faulty understanding of what history is actually there for, which is to understand, not to use in some ways, I mean, not to be a weapon. We're trying to understand the Southern tradition and say, hey, you know, there's some valuable advice here. If you don't learn from people in the past, you're bound to do incorrect things in the future. Even in your own life, you have to pass things on that are important. Traditions are important. They're there for a reason. Whether they're barriers or benefits, they're there for a reason. And this is why we talk about the tradition so much. So my long-winded soapbox there, spiel. Let's get into the material for this week. We started off the week, of course, April 12th is the anniversary of the firing on Fort Sumter. And we had a great piece by Valerie Protopapas that talked about what was the real act of aggression there? Who was really being aggressive at Sumter? And we didn't even get into the fact that Pickens was also provisioned at the same time, or at least occupied by the Union Army at the same time Sumter was. These are acts of aggression, and Lincoln was clear in it. She brings it up at the end of the piece. Lincoln started polling his cabinet in March of 1861 if he should provision the fort and Sumter and protect Pickens, and the cabinet was completely against it. Winfield Scott was completely against it. Thought we should just use the Anaconda Plan or let the South go in peace. But the fact is, Lincoln's cabinet didn't want to do it, and they didn't want to do it because they knew it would cause war. Lincoln knew it would cause war. He knew it, which is why he wanted it. He said as much in private conversations after the fact. It had the desired effect. So who was being the aggressor? Now, even as I think Ms. Protopapas makes a nice comparison of, you know, of spiking the guns at Moultrie, moving to Sumter, that was an act of aggression because, I mean, there were workers there. They seized the fort by force. There were Confederate commissioners trying to buy this thing. Seward was actually negotiating with him in a way, though he was feigning sick. In fact, James Byard of Delaware, who knew these Confederate commissioners, and they supped with him. He was relaying to his son, look, these guys are being lied to. Seward is not being on the up and up here. I fear this is going to result in an absolute failure. But Southerners were willing to buy the forts. That's an act of peace. It's not an act of war. It's an act of peace. Look, we'll pay you for them. Just we'll pay for our federal property. Just let us go. Well, why wouldn't Lincoln want to do that? Why wouldn't Lincoln just say, hey, let's let the South go? It's seven states. They're out of the Union. The United States is still a slaveholding republic at that point. The South is confined, goes no further than Texas. Well, you still got the Southwest. You still got all the Western territory. That's all still in the United States. Well, why would Lincoln want to maintain the integrity of the Union with those seven states? Well, there's two reasons. One, because he understood that a free trade South would be a major economic detriment to a protectionist North. You've got a free trade South right on the border, and the British and the French and everyone else are just going to send their ships right in there. The Germans eventually is going to send their ships right in there, and the South is going to start making bukoodles of dollars, and people are going to avoid the North, and the South will then export those products into the North. You would lose that advantage, and cotton was the big one. You would lose it. Northerners would have to trade with Southerners to get their cotton. Now, maybe they could get it from somewhere else, but that cotton export would be huge. The North would lose that advantage that they would have by keeping the South in the Union. They'd have to pay duties on it. They didn't want to do it. So you'd have that economic disadvantage. The other thing, of course, if Lincoln lets the South go, the South leaves and the seven Confederate states go and they form their own government. They're gone. You still have eight slave states in the Union. In fact, nine if you count New Jersey. You still have eight or nine slave states in the Union. Well, the United States is still a slaveholding republic. Lincoln had said over and over again, I would save the Union by freeing one slave, all the slaves are no slaves. He would do it. The war was about the Union. Maintaining the Union was what the war was about. And he needed to maintain the Union because Lincoln needed to maintain the Republican Party. If the Union dissolves and you have the South out, you still have the Democrats then will control, they would control the Congress after 1863. Lincoln would be president until 1865. He would lose in 1865. The Republican Party would cease to exist. Why? Because the issue would then be off the table. You could still say, well, there's slavery extension, which is what the Republican Party was about more than anything else. It was about slavery extension. So you would still have that. Maybe these other slave states would be looking to expand slavery into the Western territories. But Lincoln himself had put forward the idea, this is why the Corwin Amendment is actually the Lincoln Amendment. Daniel Cross does a wonderful job of this, of explaining that, you know, we'll make slavery permanent in these states. And of course, the South could still, the Confederate states could still trade in slaves with the United States if they wanted to. I mean, there was some discussion of that. So this is the dynamic of it all. Lincoln wanted to ensure that the Republican Party be maintained, and he had to do that by keeping the Union intact. And of course, the economic advantage of losing the South was too great, or disadvantage of losing the South was too great for Lincoln to overcome. So maintaining the Union was the important part of the war. Now, we can look at the South, and we can look at their secession declarations and all those things, and we can come to the conclusion that, yes, they talked about slavery. Yes, they were concerned about the Lincoln administration and what they were going to do to slavery, whether it's in the states, but more importantly, the expansion of the institution. They were worried about the Lincoln administration violating a Supreme Court decision, which is Dred Scott. Southerners pointed that and said, hey, look, the Supreme Court has said that you can't prohibit slavery in the territories. That's illegal. They're just relying on a Supreme Court decision. I mean, what's the difference now of any other state saying that the Supreme Court's ruled on this? You could take a left-wing issue and saying that, you know, if you don't abide by that, you're violating the Supreme Court, violating a decision of the Supreme Court. So a lot of stuff going on here, and I think that Ms. Protopapas does a great job of showing how it was the North and the Lincoln administration was actually the aggressor. Now, the piece on Tuesday, Separate But Equal, is a great book review by Josh Dogrell, who's, this review is fantastic. Again, it punches holes in this treasury of virtue that the North really has, a treasury of counterfeit virtue in many ways, but showing that there's a lot of complexities to the Dred Scott decision, and this book, Separate But Equal, actually gets into that. In fact, part of the review, he says, look, the author, who is a Washington Post writer, has to apologize, essentially, for writing the book. This is where we are. When you go out and the evidence points in a direction that flies in the face of wokeism. This book was written before wokeism really took over in America, but flies in the face of wokeism. Then you have to apologize for it. Why? I'll never forget that with one of the recent books on secession. The author went through pains to say that she just didn't agree with me. Oh, I apologize for writing this book. I mean, I know that the conclusions aren't necessarily leftist conclusions on this. I had to apologize for it. Why? Because she wants to ensure that she keeps a job or gets a job. She can't show. You can't show that you're somehow sympathetic with these things. Oh, no. That maybe these people have some valuable things to say. Oh, you can't do that. You can't show any admiration for conservative people in society or traditionally Southern people. I mean, even look at the latest book on Calhoun. Well, I mean, Calhoun had a lot of good, said a lot of interesting things, but I have to just show that I don't like Calhoun. Why? If Calhoun had a lot of good things to say, say it. And don't apologize for saying it. This is what history is all about. You're trying to understand these people. Why? Because he wants to ensure that he maintains a job in the academy. He wants to ensure people in the academy like him and respect him and invite him to do things. You can't do that if you're writing positive books about Southern leaders, traditional heroes. I had an art historian, send me a book, and I'll probably get to it at some point to review it, on a traditional Kentucky artist, saying that, you know, the art world doesn't even want people to write about traditional artists anymore. I mean, you can't do it. This is how ridiculous the whole situation is. That's why you have people talking about World War II, and what they're doing with that is talking about, race relations in World War II. Not even stuff that you would even think about with World War II. But this is what they're doing, because this is what the Academy has become. It's become, it's all woke, right? It's all about this. And if you don't do that, then you are facing a long shot when it comes to getting jobs and tenure and other things in the modern Academy. And it's sad because it's simply censorship. The right for years, which controlled the Academy, or you could say, you know, more conservative individuals, allowed leftists in the 60s to get in because they thought that, well, I mean, we got to let the other side come in. And then these leftists, who are really Stalinists, started pushing the other side out. And now that they have control because of tenure and other things, they won't allow conservatives in the Academy because they know that should there be a real debate, they would lose. They would lose. They can't have that. They can't have a threat to their authority. That would not work. So this little piece, I think, is great by Josh Ogrell, Separate But Equal. A very good review of this book by Steve Luxenberg. Came out in 2019. So wokeism was, you know, coming around then. Not 2020, where it got real bad. And then you have the piece by John Marcourt, Foxes in the House, looking at the renaming of Confederate military installations. And the narrative, of course, is all these things were renamed that way. This is if you follow Ty Seigeli, who says, oh, you know, all these things were renamed because of the Civil Rights Movement. They just wanted to make sure that the Civil Rights was put down. Well, as Jack points out, no, that's not true. This started out long before that. And this process continued over time. It was usually done to, you know, well, if there's a regional person that we can admire, you know, for example, Fort Benning, Georgia, named after Henry L. Benning. He's from Columbus, Georgia. The fort is in Columbus, Georgia, so it's named after a Confederate general from Columbus, Georgia. That seems pretty appropriate. I mean, why would you name it after somebody else? I guess they could say we're going to name it after James Harrison Wilson, right, because he burned the city. I'm sure that's what these idiots would want to do. Burn the city down, force people into destitute and poverty. We're going to name the fort after that guy. I mean, this is what you get. So I think Jack does an excellent job in this particular piece looking at the various bases that are under attack, who's on the committee doing it. Seigeli, of course, is on the committee. It's a joke. Committee is a complete joke. And this was put together by Republicans, who are supposedly the saviors of the South, Southern conservatives. That's why Jack wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago. Hey, there's no Southern Party. It doesn't exist. Mike Rogers from Alabama is on board with this stuff. Why? Well, because he thinks it's going to make it to where people won't call him names and he's going to curry favors with the other side. And of course, they're all being influenced by people like Karl Rove and neocons, other neocons who are simply feeding them the pro-union reconstruction side of the issue. I mean, there's two sides of the story, right? We should be cognizant of that. Karl Rove called Confederates enemies. Not enemies, they're Americans. Fighting over something that people had believed was true, which was political independence, self-determination, since the Declaration of Independence. It is the American character. The American character, as William B. Travis said at the Battle of the Alamo. It is the American character to seek self-determination. That's the important part of all of this and where I think people miss these things. On Thursday, we had a video, by Philip Lee. He's done a number of great videos on Robert E. Lee. Now, these videos were not produced for the Abbeville Institute, but they were produced for a group that's interested in maintaining the name of Lee on Washington Lee University, but they allowed us to use them, so we put them on our YouTube page as well. Very well done. This is about the post-war Lee, and you know, the best thing ever written about the post-war Lee was Lee in the Mountains by Davidson. It's a wonderful poem, and we have it on our YouTube page as well. That's really good, but We need to figure out what the post-war Lee was all about. I mean, the post-war Lee is education. The post-war Lee, and we're going to have a wonderful series of essays coming up on this. Lee's character as a Christian gentleman. It factored into West Point. It factored into Washington and Lee. It was an important part of Lee's character and something that I think those that want to take his name off the institution forget, because they've read Elizabeth Brown Pryor's book, Reading the Man, which is awful. They've read Ty Seigerly and they think, oh yeah, I mean, Lee is terrible. But when you really read Lee, that's not the opinion you get. It's not what Americans for generations thought of Robert E. Lee. It's not what Dwight Eisenhower said or Franklin Roosevelt. Take your pick of 20th century Americans that admired Lee, even right after the war, Americans that admired Lee. There were some that in the North that wanted him hung for treason, but even Grant, no, wanted none of that. I don't think Lincoln would have pursued it had he lived. That wasn't going to happen. This was a difference of opinion that resulted in a shooting contest. Of course, killed 1 million men over, could a state leave the Union? For whatever reason, could a state leave a Union? That's what the war is really about. Could a state leave the Union? Now, by a force of arms, the North said no, even though in Texas v. White, they said yes, if the Congress can kick them out. I mean, that was cover for what the radicals were doing. Unilateral secession, no, but Congress can kick a state out anytime it wants. I mean, this is just ridiculous. But that's essentially what happened in that Supreme Court decision. But certainly, the whole point of the war was to keep the South in the Union. Ending slavery was a byproduct of that, not the drive of the war. And Lincoln himself, as Phil Magnus has pointed out in a really great book about colonization, Lincoln was willing to use colonization up until the day he died. And there was some question after the Hampton Roads Conference, would Lincoln have allowed, and this has been explored now, what shall we do with the Negro, by another historian, that Lincoln was willing to postpone emancipation indefinitely if the South would just come back in the Union. And Paul Encott, and this was something that's been well documented. So if the war was all about ending slavery, why would Lincoln do this? In fact, he said, Southerners, you come back in, you can vote down the 13th Amendment. It won't even exist. You could keep slavery, in other words. You could keep it. So if that's what the war was all about, what about Southerners who were interested in abolishing the institution during the war? They talked openly about it, the Kenner Mission. There's other things that go into this. So the war is much more complex than this cartoonish slapstick foolishness that people like Seigerly and others are promoting around the United States now. It's because people don't have any historical understanding or any idea of complexity. They don't seek to understand. They seek to condemn or use. That's Eric Foner's usable past. I mean, this is what he's very famous for. So this piece, this video, 5-minute video or so on Lee, the post-war Lee, it's so good, and you got to watch it. Lee, the educator, it's a fitting end to his life. Unfortunately, died very shortly after the war was over from heart issues, had a heart attack. But the idea of the post-war Lee is something that we don't often explore, but students loved him. He established the honor code at Washington College, now Washington Lee University. He was integral in the expansion of that school and saving the school from ruin after the war was over. If anybody deserves to have his name on the school, it's Lee. The second greatest son, according to history overall, to Washington. Now, you can make a case for Madison, Jefferson, Monroe, Mason. I mean, there's a lot of other people that came out of Virginia that are important. But Lee, the stature that Lee had around the United States was just as important as George Washington, maybe even as Thomas Jefferson. And then finally, the last piece of the week on John C. Calhoun. Again, talking about the importance of John C. Calhoun and why we need to remember Calhoun. I mean, what is it about this guy from South Carolina, this gentleman from South Carolina, that resonates with Americans today, and how could it? I mean, if all he is the defender of slavery, the cast iron man, this evil man, Samuel Flagg Bemis, you get the image of Calhoun with his hair slicked back and his face sunken in by tuberculosis and death and sickness. And this is what we see of Calhoun, but you look at younger images of Calhoun, very handsome man. Clyde Wilson will tell you he had a good sense of humor, was a great conversationalist, a man who people liked to talk to. You can't say the same thing about John Quincy Adams. Nobody liked to talk to John Quincy Adams, and yet somehow John Quincy Adams is this great American. What for? Nobody liked John Quincy Adams. And I use the Byard effect with John, the Byard summary. James Byard the Elder, who was an important member of the second generation of Americans. He died fairly young, but he was on the commission that worked out the Treaty of Ghent, which ended the War of 1812. And of course, John Quincy Adams is on this commission. John Quincy Adams and James Byard did not get along. James Byard, the elder, got along with everybody in the political class. Everyone loved the guy, except John Quincy Adams. James Byard got along with political opponents. One of his opponents was a descendant of Caesar Rodney, and he actually wrote to him one time, "You're more people tick than I am," meaning that, you know, you get along better with the populace. But these two men got along quite well. And Byard was someone that everyone liked to be around, except John Quincy Adams. That shows you what kind of man John Quincy Adams was. Nobody liked John Quincy Adams, but people liked Calhoun. They genuinely liked Calhoun. Andrew Jackson didn't. And that also says something about Calhoun. Andrew Jackson was supposedly so irascible that a lot of people didn't like him either. Great general, great American hero in that way, but not someone that was very easy to get along with. Hot-tempered, just not a person that people often walked away from thinking, yeah, I really like Andrew Jackson. But they did that with Calhoun. All right. So, I hope you enjoyed this week in review at the Abbeville Institute. Until next time, good day.